Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Manu Saadia. Manu, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Scott. My pleasure.
I'm excited to have you here because I know that you are a Star Trek fan, and I'm spoiling. This is a spoiler alert, everybody. He's a Star Trek fan. He's written a very interesting book. But why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself?
So I'm a Star Trek fan. That's. And I think this is how I would characterize myself to people who don't know me. That's the first thing that comes out of my mouth. This is something that I've lived with Star Trek since I was a kid, and it's been very important in who I became. I'm from France originally, and I live in Los Angeles, and. I work when I don't write about Star Trek or when I don't watch episodes. I do work in the technology area, and I'm involved in several startups, and I help out, and that's me.
Right. Now, you kind of buried the lead here in that you are, have you finished writing the book, or are you in the midst of writing it still?
Oh, it's never over until somebody takes it out of my hands, basically. Unfortunately, no, I mean, I'm like, I'll never finish unless somebody takes it from me. So I'm editing the chapters right now, and there's a lot of rewriting. I go over some of the stuff I wrote like 6 months ago, and I'm like, wait, I wrote that. That's me. So that's the experience right now.
I completely understand. So your book is called Trekonomics, and as you might tell from the title, it is all about economics and Star Trek, which I find fascinating. And we're going to get back to that in a second, but I want to ask my traditional questions. We've already answered if you consider yourself a Star Trek fan, so we know that. Check.
Check.
The follow-up question to that is always, what is your favorite series?
So I would have had no problems answering, like, right off the bat, Next Generation. Mm-hmm. But then in the course of writing the book, I sort of evolved a little bit. And now I would say Deep Space Nine, kind of not after writing the book and researching and reading, I think Deep Space Nine has something very, very weird and interesting about it. And provocative. And somehow Deep Space Nine tells us a little more about ourselves. So this is where I would. This is where I stand right now. But it might change again. It might go back to the original series. You know, so it's a little bit like some books, you know, that you read when you're a kid. Like you reread them several times over the course of your lifetime. It's as if the books read you, and so it's a little bit the same with Star Trek. Maybe in my old age, I will really appreciate. The dynamic duo of Spock and Kirk much more. That's my answer.
Well, I think people who listen to this podcast know that Deep Space Nine I consider the best Star Trek series. I also consider The Next Generation to be my favorite Star Trek series only because of nostalgia's sakes, because it is the series that got me hooked on Star Trek. And then
I guess it's an age thing. Everybody our age sort of was a teenager watching Next Generation.
Exactly. So it hit us at the right time.
Yes. And that's why the old guys, you know, I mean, the old guys, no. The older folks, our parents' generation, they're all about the original series. And they're like, so it kind of makes sense.
That's true. And I've had someone who is much younger than me on this podcast, and their favorite series, shockingly enough, was Enterprise. So,
nice.
Which the episode we're watching today or discussing, we've already watched it, is an Enterprise episode called Singularity, which is a season two episode? Yep, season two, episode nine. But before we dive into this action-packed episode of Enterprise, let's talk a little bit about Trekonomics, because this is a thing that I find fascinating in the Star Trek universe. So I'm glad that you've written a book about it, because the economics, I'm not sure how they work, but they are interesting, because the Federation, now correct me if I'm wrong, but the Federation is what's known in the biz is a post-scarcity society, right? Because they have unlimited energy and they can transform energy into matter. So nobody wants for anything, theoretically.
Yes. So to backtrack a little bit, this is something actually shocking to me. And I was trying to look for a book that dealt with that issue specifically. You know, you probably read The Physics of Star Trek, mm-hmm. By Lawrence Krauss. Amazing book. And then, you know, you have tons of other books, lots of scholarship on Star Trek and television, on Star Trek and religion, Star Trek and political science. And somehow nobody has even ever bothered to actually write something about the economics of Star Trek. And I was really pissed off at that. So this is like, okay, I'll do it. And yes, so that's the thing that I find surprising about it, is that it seems to me that it's much more important, in fact, and even in Gene Roddenberry's original vision, than the gizmos or space travel or the Vulcans or the transporter or things like that. It seems to me that the core of the vision or the core of the message is really about the organization of society. Mm-hmm. If you strip out Star Trek from, you know, the space opera, so to speak, you can still imagine it as, you know, a society without warp drive and transporter, for instance, could still probably work. You don't need all that crazy technology and space opera to actually make Star Trek work in the real world. So that was my point of departure, or my question, rather. So this is how it came about. And yes, it is a post-scarcity society. And that, it is a described in incredible details. I mean, it's always in the background, right? I mean, when you think about it, the T. L. Gray Hot, the Picard's famous moniker or slogan or whatever, you know, he always says that. When you think about it, like the replicator in his ready room is not necessary at all. Like, they could have had people actually bring him his tea, or he could have had a thermos or something like that. But they put it in. They put it in specifically to say something about the nature of work and the nature of automation in the future. Because when you think about it, the replicator doesn't add anything to any of the stories. Zero. So it's right there. It's pure color. It's to demonstrate something. It's to say something. It's like it's right there as a rhetorical device.
On episode 61 of Random Trek, Marcus Huerta, who's a scientist, was making the point that replicators are incredibly inefficient, and it would make more sense just to bring food with you on a starship and resupply every once in a while. But I think what you're saying, and I agree with you, is that that's not the point of the replicators. A, they're cool, but B, they are a powerful symbol of the Federation and kind of their, you know, it's post-scarcity. You could just walk up to one of these machines and say, you know, I want tea, I want a chocolate sundae.
But, you know, they're a metaphor, but they're a metaphor for something much greater, I think, or much bigger. When you talk about economics, they sort of remove labor. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. Nobody needs to work if you have replicators. There is this scene, you know, you remember that episode of Next Generation, Data's Day, when it's Keiko and Miles O'Brien who are getting married, and you have Geordi and Worf who go to the main replicating unit in the Enterprise to find a present.
Oh, right, yes.
You know, and they're dorks, so they're like, what do you get for a wedding, you know? And it's like, this is how you shop, and this is the Amazon of the 24th century. I mean, it's like you just go up to the replicator and you choose a design. So it removes any kind of work, any kind of transportation, and so the point I make in the book is that this is really something that's inspired by Asimov mostly, mm-hmm. And Star Trek is really, especially Next Generation and after Next Generation, is really a sort of an expansion and a deep dive into the consequences of Asimov's speculations. And so that's, well, you'll have to read the book, I guess.
That's right. We don't want to spoil it. I do want to touch on something. So I think it's interesting that the Federation, Next Generation, even the original series, didn't really talk about money in general, because the Federation is a cashless society and they don't use money. Deep Space Nine brings in this whole idea of gold press latinum and the Ferengi, and the Ferengi are obsessed with money, and it's clear that they still have a vibrant economy.
Oh, they're awesome. I love the Ferengis. And you'll notice, by the way, that for Deep Space Nine officers, like Federation officers, it's actually okay to hang out at Quark's and pay their tab. I mean, they all have a tab. So it seems that all of them have some kind of credit account supplied by the Federation.
So now let's talk about the episode that the random episode generator has forced upon us. The episode Singularity Enterprise Season 2, Episode 9 has nothing to do with economics. I do not believe money of any sort comes up in the course of this episode.
Not at all.
No. And so let's talk a little bit about Enterprise and your thoughts about Enterprise. So how do you feel about Enterprise?
I have a very funny story about it. So we moved into the neighborhood a couple summers ago. And so we're having the neighbors over for, you know, drinks. They have like two daughters and we have a boy. So they play together. And then I'm asking the neighbor, so what do you do? What do you do? How do you do? And he's like, oh, I'm a writer. I was like, what do you write for? He's like, oh, I've worked on Desperate Housewives and, you know, Mad Men and Star Trek Enterprise. And then I'm like, whoop. And, you know, my eyes like bulge. And it's probably like at this point, I see his eyes bulge, but, you know, in despair, like, oh, no, not another one of these. And then I'm like, well, you know, I feel Enterprise doesn't get enough credit. I feel Enterprise is underrated. And I was watching this episode, Carbon Creek, last week, which I was, you know, and then it's like, oh, I wrote that. And turns out he's Chris Black. So he's the guy who wrote that particular episode. He's the guy who wrote Singularity as well.
Yes, he wrote this episode. And he also wrote another episode that we covered, Doctor's Orders.
Yes, and he did write with Andrew Borman some of the great Vulcan episodes later in Enterprise. So, so Chris Black is my buddy, he's my neighbor, and is one of the people who encouraged me to write the book, actually. So, well, I'm not taking the fifth, but I'm just saying.
I'm going to say that you've very nicely skirted around the question, but I won't press because that's not the kind of podcast I run.
Yes, I do actually like Enterprise. And it's a show I think we've all watched and felt maybe did not fully realize all its potential for reasons that may not have had much to do with the show itself or the premise. Mm-hmm. I think the ratings throughout the history of the show were not as good as people expected. And as a result, there was a lot of pressure to juice it up a little bit. And there was pressure. And I feel Enterprise could have been so much more than what it is. But what it is already, I think, pretty interesting and pretty good, at least to me, overall. And I'm not saying that because Chris is my friend. It's Star Trek, you know? I mean, come on. It's cool.
Well, exactly. And that's what I say. I mean, Enterprise is my least favorite series of all the series, but it is still Star Trek. And it's, you know, I love it because it is Star Trek. And it does interesting things. It has some interesting characters.
Yeah, it's not just because it's Star Trek. It's because it's actually good TV compared to, you know, a lot of the science fiction on TV that we can see. It's very good TV and it's very thoughtful and they're really trying hard.
That is true. Although there are a few things that annoy me every time I watch an Enterprise episode. The biggest is the theme song.
The opening credits. I had written this down because I think it's interesting. The opening sequence has this sort of a triumphant version of human history. Like we're all explorers from the beginning and all that. And that's, you know, that's kind of the tale we tell ourselves. But the truth is, humanity is incredibly sedentary. And actually, the reason why there is civilization is because we have cities. So, you know, we don't want to go further than 5 miles away from where we live most of the time. So, no, humanity is not like this kind of bunch of great explorers setting forth onto kind of Star Trek. I mean, it's just so I understand the this is part of the whole PR campaign, or, you know, to continue space exploration, and it's very worthy for science, but I don't know if, you know, it was necessary. And the song kind of, you know, but
yes,
they wanted to be different.
They did want to be different, and they accomplished that goal, so kudos to them. It is different than any other opener, so mission accomplished.
There's a bit of Zefram Cochrane in there, you know?
Yes, that's true.
Like, and I kind of, you know, they show actually the Phoenix in the opening sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, everybody remembers the first contact in the moment when Zefram Cochrane is like, oh, I forgot something. And then he puts on the rock and roll. And you're like, okay, I dig that. So there's a little bit of that.
Although he plays a much better song than they just played for the theme song.
Probably
for
could not afford that song.
So. Well, that is true. So this episode, I'll do a quick recap just because it's very quick, is a simple premise. The Enterprise is, they find a singularity, a black hole to those not in the biz, right? They want to check it out because the Vulcan database has thousands of black holes cataloged, but none in a tri-star system, so they go check it out. And, oh no!
Trinary black hole. It sounds like a cocktail.
Yes, it's a, you could get a White Russian or a trinary black hole. And of course, you know, it's not going to just be an easy check out this black hole thing. The black hole's emitting some kind of radiation that seemingly makes people super obsessed with trivial matters. And so all the crew is being obsessed. The only person who is immune from this is T'Pol. And she kind of cracks the code and figures out something's going wrong, and they need to pilot the ship out and get it away from the singularity before everybody dies. And she can't do it by herself for some reason, so she needs to get Captain Archer, who's almost unconscious. So she wakes him up, Captain Archer.
Puts him in the shower.
Puts him in the shower, which I always find it amusing that Enterprise, I feel like Enterprise goes out of its way to get people in the bathroom because no other Star Trek series has shown the bathroom. So they want to say, we are showing the bathrooms.
Well, they want to make well, there's that. And then they want to make, you know, space look a little more dirty and complicated than a pleasure cruise or the you know, love boat of the Enterprise. That being said, you know, I mean, the premise is basically they're revisiting prior Star Trek episodes. I mean, they're revisiting the Naked Now and Naked Time all at the same time. I mean, they're part of it's kind of the exploration of Star Trek's mythology. Although, not to say that the Naked Now is hardly part of Star Trek's mythology. I would say it's a bottle show. And, you know, it's the second episode of the first season of TNG, and it's the one where Data and Tasha Yar have some kind of encounter.
A connection.
Connection.
Where we find Data is fully functional.
Fully functional.
And interestingly, so the whole crew is knocked out in Singularity. And in one of Chris Black's other episodes, Doctor's Orders, the whole crew is knocked out except for one person. So I think he likes this idea of knocking people out and having a ship that is usually bustling, kind of being everyone's incapacitated. And,
you he's know. Really into, yeah, I mean, he's really into the horror type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the part where the ship becomes, just, it's just a machine and one man. I mean, there is something of Alien in there. I mean, T'Pol is a very competent Ripley, I think.
Yes.
I can say, you know, I mean, she doesn't kick ass as much, but she's very, I like her. She's a great Vulcan. I mean, she's kind of the, and you know, I was reading an interview by Brandon Braga, so the producer and writer of Enterprise with Rick Berman, where he discusses the fact, well, you know, Jolene is a great actress, and because he was trying to dispute the fact that they had hired her just because she looked like a babe. You know, like the seven of nine
syndrome. Yes. Yeah.
But the truth is, both Blaylock and Jeri Ryan are amazing actresses, and they do the best of what they're given. And I think you know, as a Vulcan, she's at least to me, T'Pol is the most interesting character to me in Enterprise and throughout. And the Vulcans are the most interesting.
One of the interesting things I find on Enterprise is I agree with you. I think the two most interesting characters on the show are both the non-human characters. Well, three most interesting because Porthos, you got to count Porthos. He's so cute. Yes. T'Pol and also Dr. Phlox I find fascinating. The rest of the characters, not so fascinating, but...
It's kind of a... You were mentioning earlier that you... Yeah, I mean... Archer is kind of a flawed character, but think about it this way. These guys are like, they're basically on a very short leash from the Vulcan Academy of Science or the High Command. I mean, like, they're almost like they're not doing exactly anything they want. The setup is complicated for the humans in Enterprise. If you take it, you know, literally or at face value, it's like, okay, we're exploring at Warp 5, but actually we're not free to do anything.
Well, that's true. And I guess Captain Archer is a little frustrated by that. But I'm frustrated by Captain Archer as a character because I feel like, and I tweeted this the other day, every time I watch an Enterprise episode, I am reminded of how bad a captain Captain Archer is. And I hold that up still in this episode. And some people tweeted back to me and said, well, you don't understand because that's kind of part of the character because he's new at this, so he doesn't know what to do. And I find that to be flimsy reasoning because in this episode, he does things that I think a captain would never do.
There's an interesting part about this, and it's part of the episode where there's this discussion of whether this is a military ship or not. And that hasn't really been decided yet in the Star Trek universe, like whether Starfleet or the fleet, as they call it, is a military force or a police force or more of an exploration. And you know, I call it like a galactic fire department. that's what the Enterprise later becomes. It's fire department. There's a problem, we send the Enterprise. But other than that, you know, it's like it's the love boat. So, but we never see that because it's boring.
And I think that scene between Reed and Archer is good because obviously Reed and this is even before or maybe at the very beginning of when people are getting affected by this radiation. He's always obsessed with he's the weapons officer, right? So he's obsessed with security and he wants there to be a system where the weapons can come online automatically and the shields will power up or the hull will power up because they don't have shields. And Archer's
the ablative armor.
Exactly. And Archer is like, well, you know, we're not a military ship, so don't call it battle stations. And don't call it, you know, something aggressive. Make it sound nice, but I think it's a good idea. And I thought that was a good thing. But the thing that bothers me in this episode, two things that Archer does bother me. One, so Trip, who's the engineer, Archer pulls him aside, and he's like, hey, Trip, my chair. You've got to fix my chair. I can't sit on it. And Trip is like, well, I was going to do some seemingly important thing. Can this wait? And Archer's like, no, do the chair first. And I was like, really?
Doesn't that go with the whole obsessive compulsive effect of the radiation? Like,
well, see, that's the one thing
that could be explained away.
You could explain that away. Although I still think that the radiation isn't affecting them yet, but maybe it is. So that's fine. And then, as a writer,
a smidgen.
As a writer, it offends me when he asks if T'Pol will write the foreword for his father's this book about his father. Now that's a minor quibble, but
I mean, that's true. That's a very good point. Although, he feels uncomfortable about it because I think you could explain that by the psychology of it, whereby his father is such a great man who worked with Ephraim Cochran and who built ships for humanity, and he's just a lowly captain. Something like that, maybe.
But he's the captain of the first Warp 5 capable ship that humans have ever had or built.
So maybe, I feel this is something that's constant with the character throughout. Like, he has real trouble wearing the uniform. so to speak, and being the captain. And because in a way it's in state of flux, it's not yet the captain's chair. It's not yet the captain as we know the captain to be.
And it's his job to kind of figure it out, and he's doing the best that he can. But it still annoys me.
There's something to go along that military theme, and it's the galley kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to touch up on that because I think it's fascinating. You know how on submarines, the galley, the kitchen, the mess hall is the most important part of the ship. And I think this is very successful in that particular episode of Enterprise. The role of the kitchen and the role of eating and food in those situations where you're basically your whole life as a human depends on a machine. And, you know, outside of these walls, it's space. And if these walls don't function, if the ship doesn't function, you're dead. And so you're sort of powerless when you're inside that ship, even though you have all these crazy weapons and, you know, all that. And so food is really, and that's very similar to submarines. And food is where it's the ritual of eating is really what keep people in touch with their humanity when they're, you know, out at sea or under sea or in space. And I think at least that part in that episode was very successful.
Yes.
The obsession about food makes sense to me.
It's true. Although, and this is also a minor quibble, but I thought that, so they have all the characters get obsessed with something, right? So the cook is sick, so he can't make dinner or lunch or whatever he's supposed to make.
It's Hoshi, sadly.
So Hoshi's like, I'll do it because I have this recipe that my family has. I love it and I want to share it with the crew, which is a nice thing. But then I start thinking about, and maybe this is when I'm overanalyzing it, but I think, did they really have to pick one of the few female characters and make her want to cook for everybody?
I didn't want to go there, but I get your point. Fair enough. Because
That's, you know, I'm just saying. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think maybe it would have been better if they had maybe what's his face, Malcolm.
Malcolm was busy with the weapons, dude.
Yeah, so. Or the navigator guy whose name I can't remember, Mayweather.
Yes.
Maybe if he cooked, and then Hoshi could have had the creepy scenes with Dr. Phlox that I want to get into because I think those were the best parts of this episode.
Yes. But maybe think about it this way. If they had Hoshi with Dr. Phlox, you know, kids watch this show. So it might have been much creepier.
Well, that's true. It could have been too scary.
There's that. And then, yeah, okay. The how do you say that? The heteronormativity of Star Trek is something that has been discussed at great lengths.
Yes.
And yes, and we will leave it at that.
That's
but it's a yes. It's a yes.
There's room to improve.
And I think, you know, David Gerald originally, so David Gerald is the guy who wrote Tribbles, and he was working on the original series. And originally in 87, 88, when they were developing Next Generation, he was on the team with DC Fontana and, you know, all these old timers. And he was like, hey, it's time to put on, you know, it's time to put on a gay character on the show. And that sort of did not fly with, I mean, there was only so far they could go, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But by the way, there is some less heteronormative characters or set pieces in Deep Space Nine, especially with the Ferengi woman. But it's kind of played as comedy. So. Right.
Now, this is why I think Star Trek has a good record in dealing with issues of all kinds, and it's certain less of a good record in very specific issues. But I feel like if there is going to be, and I hope there will be, a new modern day series, they have a great opportunity to deal with a lot of issues that they just couldn't.
Honestly,
deal with.
They have no choice. And it's, they have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other interesting thing is that in the history of fandom itself, from the very early on in the early 70s, fandom was queer, fandom was gay, fandom was, you know, black. And like a lot of people and great figures of Star Trek fandom were minority people and the LGBTs. And this was never fully recognized, you know, by fans. today and by the showrunners and the producers. So I think there's something to be said about this. I will send you, there's this amazing book by a professor at USC about this, of the anthropology of fandom.
And I'll include, if you send me a link, I'll include that in the show notes.
Yes, I will do that.
So let's talk, I'll quickly run down what everybody's obsessed with in this episode, and then I think we could talk about Dr. Phlox, because I think he's the most interesting. So Trip is obsessed with fixing the captain's chair, which is played mostly for comedy. Reed is obsessed with creating this alert system, which briefly is named the Reed Alert, which is kind of funny. Hoshi is obsessed with creating this perfect rendition of her family recipe. Captain Archer is obsessed with writing this forward about his father for this book, to the point where he yells at Porthos in a very sad scene, and Porthos
scurries
away. Mayweather is obsessed with not being reprimanded for doing a poor job. But he doesn't
want to be late on the bridge.
Basically, he doesn't want to be late. And Dr. Phlox is obsessed with figuring out what's wrong with Ensign Mayweather.
and Phlox in that, I mean, I don't want to be under the knife with that guy. Because when he turns obsessive,
so Mayweather comes in and says, I have a headache. And Dr. Phlox is like, well, let's find out what's going on with this headache. And Mayweather's like, well, can't you just give me some aspirin or something? And Dr. Phlox is offended. He says, I can't just give you something. I need to do tests. And
so isn't that also like there's something funny? Because isn't that the experience you get whenever you go see a doctor? It's like, I mean, at least at our advanced age where they're like, you know, that spot on your head maybe warrants a biopsy, you know? And so you're like, oh, God, no. And yeah, there's something about that.
<That's> true.
You know, it's like you go to the doctor and you end up with like a list of tests. So there was an element of that in the, except that, you know, Mayweather is a young and strapping young ensign.
He just has a headache, although he's being affected by this radiation. And Dr. Phlox sees that he's being affected by this radiation. But Dr. Phlox doesn't know is that he himself is being affected by it. And so he makes Mayweather stay for tests overnight. And then those are inconclusive. So he's like, well, I'll just take a piece of your brain.
Yeah, like the trepanation. I mean, you know, it's almost like let's perform a lobotomy and see how well you do after that.
Exactly. See, maybe it'll fix the problem.
No, but like, the part that's really creepy, and I think that's why they couldn't put Sato in there, is like he straps him onto the board and basically like it rams him into the CT scan or whatever machine it is.
Yeah. That is the way they play that scene is super effective, because so he Mayweather's like, I really have to go. And Phlox is like, well, just at least let me give you something for the headache. And he knocks
him
out.
Finally, you know, like, give me something. Finally, exactly. That's all I asked. And then, bam.
And Phlox knocks him out and straps him to the table and forces him to go into this test. And then later on, he's all suited up, ready to basically lobotomize Mayweather. And T'Pol comes in and she's like, doctor.
Yeah, with the gloves and stuff. I mean, it's creepy. It's creepy.
And Dr. Phlox very plainly threatens T'Pol with a scalpel. And luckily for us, the Vulcan nerve pinch works on Denoblians. Yes.
It was one of the first nerve pinches I saw in Enterprise, as far as I remember. And I love nerve pinches are just awesome. It's like, especially, you know, I would be a candidate to get a nerve pinch from T'Pol every day of the week. And so we should talk about T'Pol, because she's like, even that, I think in that episode she actually is great.
She's the one that figures out what's going on.
Yeah, and she's not affected by the radiation, which is something, I mean, that is how they tell the story. You'd think the Vulcans, you know, physiognomy and, you know, biology, like, they're not immune to radiation. Come on. I mean, come on.
So what did you think about this episode overall?
I mean, it's a bottle show. So, you know, it all stays within the ship. And as a result, bottle shows are always complicated, most of them. And if you go back to, you know, even the original series, some of the worst episodes are bottle shows. Because it's really hard to tell a story within the confines of the ship and stuff happening on the ship. So it's a nice try. I mean, it doesn't work as well as other episodes where you actually meet aliens. It's not an Alien of the Week type of episode. No. And as a result, it's supposed to showcase the relationship and grow the characters, as they say in the business. And the thing, though, is like, how can you grow the characters when the story is actually about losing your inhibitions or becoming obsessive compulsive?
Right, and so acting out and of acting, character, right?
Yes, so. Exactly. So there's that. And then there's this tradition of, in Star Trek at least, of, you know, the weird radiation or plague affecting the whole crew and making them do crazy things.
Manu, thank you so much for joining me and talking about Star Trek and Enterprise and your book, Trekonomics. Everybody, check it out. There'll be a link in the show notes.
Thank you very much, Scott. That was a pleasure, and hopefully we'll do it again.
I'm sure we will.
Next on Random Trek, the original series, Season 2, Mirror, Mirror.